Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis. It's the 4th of April 2014 and I'm speaking with Stein Klassens, Assistant Director in the Research Department at the IMF and Professor of International Finance Policy at the University of Amsterdam. We discuss the recent IMF book Stein co-edited titled Global Crises, Causes, Consequences and Policy Responses, which provides a comprehensive overview of research into financial crises and the policy lessons learned. The book covers a range of crises and addresses prevention and management. I began by asking Stein to explain his motivation for compiling the book.
Well, I think we've seen too many crises. Unfortunately, they also keep coming back. This is not a matter of just the last decade or so, or even before then when we saw crises in emerging markets in Asia and elsewhere. But we've seen them over hundreds of years. Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff have contributed also to the book, made it very clear that this is a phenomenon that extended over centuries. And secondly, they have a long and large impact on the economy, on people, on growth, on jobs, on employment. So it is a big phenomenon, so we really need to understand it better. And that's what motivated the book.
So I guess we could take the title of the book as a basic structure for our approach to this discussion. And the book is titled Financial Crises, Causes, Consequences, and Policy Responses. Let's begin with the causes. What does the book tell us about the causes, and what are the recognizable early signals or alarm bells that indicate that the crisis is potentially on the horizon?
So the book covers many types of crisis, banking crisis, currency crisis, sovereign crisis, and we've seen them sometimes overlap as banking crisis, cross-currency crisis, and the European ones where we've had sovereign impact as well. So the causes, of course, are always going to vary a little bit between these crises, but the commonality that is often there, unfortunately we only discover that after the crisis, is these asset price booms. And here we're talking about house prices, sometimes equity prices, but often real estate, and that extend for quite a while, and then also are combined with credit booms, so rapid growth in credit beyond what we would normally expect from a business cycle improvement. And as these booms occur, vulnerabilities build up. That can be domestically, that can be at the corporate sector, at the household sector, or it can be externally. And those are really the warning signs that, unfortunately, people do ignore, but nevertheless exposed. We see them, and that's what is the biggest common to all of these crises.
Yeah, so I guess an obvious question, why do you think it is the case that more economists didn't foresee or anticipate the 2007-2009 global financial crisis?
I think there were a lot of good things happening before that crisis. We had the so-called Great Moderation, which economists used to indicate that we had not so severe business cycles. We had a little bit of recessions in 2001, but they were small. They were managed well. Also, when there were financial events, at least in advanced countries, they tended to be managed relatively easily by accommodative monetary policy or fiscal policy. So people thought they had fixed it, quote-unquote. Many macroeconomists were talking about we basically tamed the problems. And to the extent that there were crises, they were considered to be kind of isolated incidents. Japan was always considered to be a sui generis case. The emerging markets that had run into crisis were often thought to be weak institutions. But that lulled the whole thinking, everybody kind of into a group thinking mode of, well really we don't have to worry. Now there were some exceptions. Some people did make warning signals. I mentioned Reinhart and Rogoff. They were one of the earlier ones. Of course, Nirel Rubini was there early on, but by and large they were still ignored because there were no warning signals. Inflation was low, no big signals except for that credit boom in many countries and clearly house price increases that went beyond what should have happened. So exposed again, we were all thinking too much in the same way that we had forwarded the big problems.
We move on to what the book tells us then about what we should be doing to prevent another global crisis. Or do you think that these crises are of this sort of long wave of capital development, or is it more complex than that?
Well, I think there are many things to do, and so the book talks about both what needs to be done on the domestic side, and we can talk about it more. You're asking more about how we can prevent the global crisis, and this is a tricky one. I mean, we've seen rapid financial globalization in the last two decades before the crisis, large capital increases, flow increases, much new equity flows around the world, banks extending many, many countries. And it probably went faster than the institutional environment allowed. We talk about what people have called international financial architecture, again, the rules in place to manage the global financial system. And there, progress has been less than had been on the domestic side. Even there, it wasn't perfect. So we have kind of an incomplete system. We don't know how to resolve large financial institutions across borders. We don't know how to deal with excessive capital flows. Should we impose capital flow management, capital controls, yes or no? So then when a crisis like in a major financial center like the U.S. and subsequently U.K., Europe happened, that easily spread around the world as we couldn't kind of isolate it and manage that component of it. Is it a natural consequence of long-term capital development? I hope not. I hope we can fix the institutional side and make that better suited, that we don't have to see this again. Having said that, crises have been with us for a long time and are likely to continue to occur from time to time. It's partly because they come in different shapes and different forms. We recognize them only too late. And often the political economy is also not so eager and willing to tackle the problems when they start building up, as things are too good. And as a consequence, people rather just ride the wave a little bit longer until it is too late, unfortunately.
Now we come to the effects of the financial crisis. We've all felt the effects, but the book presents this in two parts. There are short-term and medium-term effects. Could you elaborate a little on these two, perhaps, for us?
Yeah, the short-term effect, I mean, as you said, everybody has felt them in one way or the other. So in that sense, what the book demonstrates, that these are patterns common across crises, across countries, is in some sense by now well-known, well-felt, established fact. What the book does in its various papers is look a little bit more, how can you mitigate these short-term effects? So how can you mitigate the large drop in output, or how can you mitigate the unemployment across them? And it focuses on the obvious one, on fiscal and monetary policy, which is interestingly very different this time around than it was in other crises. Because this were advanced countries, monetary and fiscal policy had more scope to mitigate the crisis. And we see that. I mean, it wasn't as deep as we have seen before. It wasn't as long as we have seen before. So that was useful. What was, however, the consequence of kind of mitigating the sharp cost was that there was maybe less pressure to do the deep restructuring. So that's where the book also analyzes it quite in depth and saying, well, maybe more could have been done on cleaning of the balance sheets of banks, corporations, and households, so that we could have gotten a quicker recovery following the decline. And that is, I think, still where many countries today even are struggling with household restructuring, with corporate restructuring. So that's more the short-term effect. The long-term effect is actually quite a puzzle in many ways. A typical economist's view of economic growth would say, well, okay, we had this crisis, and after the crisis, we fixed the banks, which is more or less being done. We shouldn't have this large output loss for a long time. However, it does seem to that a crisis leads to a lot of dislocations, a lot of changes in the economy. It may also have been the sign of an overextension in the real side. So the long-term consequences, I think, were the least well understood, and I think we have to live with that quite a bit longer. Advanced countries have low growth, lower than before, they have more unemployment, so there is a longer consequence that we still at this point don't fully understand.
And the book, I know, brought together leading academics as well as staff from the IMF. Do you think that sort of combination worked? And if so, why was it so effective? And what do you think it added to the outcome of the book?
I mean, I think this has been an area where at least a number of academics, not too many, unfortunately, so that's where this paradigm problem arose before the crisis. But nevertheless, some had been working, so we've been inviting them over the years to bring them in and give them feedback and relearning from them. And I think this is a useful interaction. The IMF and other international institutions are very much hands-on in terms of crisis management, and it's sometimes useful to step back and see the bigger picture and see where things are coming from. It's also useful for an academic to say things beyond what we as an IMF or international institution can say in terms of how to tackle deeper, more complex, often political economy issues. So that made it for a good balance. And we had the leading people, Yun Chin, who's moving to the BIS, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff and Alan Taylor, they're very much involved. Jose de Gregorio has extensive experience on the emerging market side. So it was a nice mix of people to have them discuss these issues.
And what do you think, Stein, the implications of what we have now learned and some of the messages that are coming out of this book, what have we learned in terms of, do you think, the sort of economics curriculum for PhD and for teaching economics generally? Do we need to change the models? Do we need to rethink what it is that is being taught to young economists coming through academia these days?
I think there are lessons, and they're being drawn. I mean, academics have been writing on it. Paul Krugman, Carter Caballero has had some very nice pieces right after the crisis. Have we missed the boat as a profession on this, and what should we learn from this? I think there was kind of too much of a separation between macroeconomics and finance. The macroeconomists focused on the business cycle and inflation, often developing very good, elaborate micro-founded models, the so-called dynamic stochastic equilibrium models, which gave us a lot of insight. But unfortunately, at times, we were ignoring some realities on the macro side. And then on the finance side, we had many people pushing for kind of the markets are efficient, they work well, we do not need to worry about regulating too much, or at least about market failures and what have you. And the two didn't really talk to each other. They were in kind of independent professions for quite a while. So I think what's being done now is really integrating two streams much closer. It's hard to bring finance into the macroeconomy in terms of modeling, and it's hard because we only see these crises once a while. So we can learn a lot from these crises, but it's an expensive way to learn. But the profession is starting to change. I see many, many good papers now that try to bring the two fields together.
So you're a European at heart. You're based the other side of the pond, as we say. But what is your take on this kind of nexus or the link between the bank debt and the sovereign debt in Europe? Is there a way out of that perpetual circle?
I think there are ways out. It's not easy. I do tend to think you have to start often on the bank side to make sure that the banks are sound and solid, and I think they're doing quite a bit through the asset quality review that the ECB has started and other agencies are involved in. But it may also require something on the fiscal side, and there are proposals, Eurobonds being the one most extreme version of it, but some ways of to create greater burden sharing fiscally, such that the individual country sovereign is less of a concern for a country banking system. That's a major issue. It's been on the table for a while, but I think eventually for Europe, as a Europe, at least within the Eurozone, that is something that would have to be considered, some greater fiscal burden sharing, some greater transfers to make sure that shocks are not so disruptive to both sovereigns and eventually to banking systems.
And so finally, Stein, the book looks at suggested policy measures to prevent booms, mitigate busts, and avoid financial crises, and it also looks at issues like bank, household, and sovereign restructuring. It's a really broad set of conclusions and a really ambitious book in its scope, but how could you summarize for us the key messages from the book?
Well, I think, I mean, there's many areas where reforms are needed to kind of prevent these crises from happening, and you can talk about the macroeconomics, I mentioned monetary fiscal policy, talk about financial regulation, international architecture, and it's easy to come up with a laundry list. I think what's most important is kind of having a more system perspective, to not look at the isolated individual bank or household or corporation, but we're looking at what's happening in the system as a whole, and then complementing that view with kind of a macroprudential toolkit to go in and at times say, well, okay, it looks fine at the micro level, but I'm worried about the system, that this bank is getting too big, or this sector is getting too much credit, or these asset prices are increasing too rapidly. That's a tricky issue because, again, we don't know everything. But the toolkit is starting to be developed. Many central banks are starting to get ready for it. I'm hopeful that can be done, which means intervening through a loan-to-value ratio to prevent a household from borrowing too much for his house, maybe a capital charge at the bank that doesn't extend itself too rapidly. These issues are being discussed and happening. The second part, I think, is what you alluded to in terms of the restructuring, whether it's household, whether it's banks or sovereign. And I think in all of these areas, we still don't have the perfect solution. I already mentioned very large cross-border banks that we can't resolve too easily. But you can also think of the sovereign restructuring of sovereign debt that is still difficult, whether it's Greece or whether it's any other country. We often come to that late in the game, and then the costs are often incurred. So we have to do better there. Again, people are thinking about it. It's complicated. But hopefully we can at least avoid the large, long-run cost of these crises going forward.
Stein Klassen, thanks very much indeed.
You're very welcome. Thank you.